This week's Linux Daily is brought to you by the Golden Group and the event they produce, ISPCon. The event is being held April the 14th through 16th. Check it out at ispcon.com. Also, IDG World Events. And there are two events, the Linux World Conference and Expo and Macworld. Also, Linux Journal, linuxquestions.org, linuxtoday.com, and Fuse, F-Y-U-Z-E.com. But most of all, we'd like to thank you, the listeners, who throw a few dollars in our tip jar. It takes us a couple hours a day to produce this show. If you like what we do, think of it as a 25-cent per day investment. That works out to a mere $100 per year to subscribe for our show. So, is 25 cents a day too much to ask for a couple of hours of our time? And now, on with our show. Hello, this is Jeff Gerhardt, and you're listening to the Linux Today show for April the 7th, 2004. On Monday's show, we brought you through a brief history of the time frame from the Caldera IPO of 2000, the purchase of the SCO product at that time, through the end of the Ransom Love administration of the Caldera Group. We also brought you a little bit of information of the time frame from when Darryl MacBride immediately was put in control of the company, the first initial few steps he took in terms of, one, recognizing that the company was a fairly second-rate Linux company, but had a pretty remarkable thing within the SCO channel sitting out there. And so Darryl decided to focus the energies of the company into grooming that channel. He did a number of logical steps. He, first of all, changed the name to SCO. He developed some products that would be easily absorbable, easily digestible, and easily sellable by the existing SCO channel. And he began the process, although very subtly at first, talking about the intellectual property of the Unix space. Darryl was an extremely popular man in the late summer and early fall of 2002. The people within the channel liked what he did. The people who were the stockholders liked what he did. And he was a popular man. Stock price wasn't soaring yet, but he was still a very popular man. Some great initial steps. Over on the Linux side of the ledger, a number of us started to become suspicious at that time as well. Suspicious, but there was nothing to prove. We just had feelings. But when Chris Sontag joined the organization as the defender of the intellectual property, or the person who's going to groom the intellectual property, that's when the red flags really started to go up the flagpole. I'm going to give a little sidestep right here. That is to state that I now, looking back in hindsight, and of course, hindsight is 20/20, it is my opinion that I am completely convinced that Sontag was brought into the organization to sue somebody, to develop a team of legal resources to go after intellectual property. I think IBM was just unfortunate to be the first likely target to come along. They're a big company, deep pockets, and SCO indeed had a big excuse. So what has this all got to do with the cult of personality that I was referring to? Well, it's logical enough. Regardless of what may have been going on in the minds, in the devious little dark recesses of Chris Sontag's mind, there's no question of the fact that SCO was caught off guard by the decisions of IBM to follow the Linux path as deeply as they had. SCO had, well, not bet the farm, but invested quite a bit of time, quite a bit of money, into a joint development project of a 64-bit Unix kernel. No doubt SCO was mightily upset when IBM decided to pull out of that project. No doubt that SCO was outraged and decided to sue. In their same place, most of us may have done the exact same thing. There's a lot of he said, she said, he said, he said, whatever said, finger-pointing going on back and forth between SCO and IBM, a lot of accusations. But regardless of the actual string or path that you choose to follow, bottom line is IBM decided that Linux had matured enough that that was the path that they were going to follow. SCO became a redundancy, a waste of money. SCO didn't like being considered a redundancy and a waste of money, and started waving that contract around in the courtroom, and initiated a lawsuit against IBM for breach of contract. That is what started everything. It was only later that SCO started to use the Linux kernel as a device in this court case. Now, when you're sitting within a company like SCO that's just got a couple of hundred people, and you're up against a company like IBM, which has got bajillions of people and bajillions of dollars, one of a couple of things happens to the population and the people within your own company. A certain percentage of them take flight. They're gone. Another percentage of them, well, they're sort of like the old pioneers traveling across the American West in Conestoga wagons. When the Indians come charging up, they circle up the wagons around their leadership. And this is what has happened at SCO. You see, the people at SCO saw the things that Darryl McBride had done from the summer of 02 forward. And they were sitting there within that company listening to the chanting, the mantra, of all of the litany of the sins of IBM. And why should they believe that Darryl would lie to them? They didn't have evidence of Darryl lying to them. Darryl was indeed their savior. Darryl came in and Darryl reinvigorated the SCO channel. Darryl added new products for the SCO channel to take advantage of. Darryl was indeed a great man in their eyes. The majority of the employees and the majority of the officers who were in the SCO organization became sucked in by Darryl McBride and by Chris Sontag as well. They had no reason to believe initially that these men would be lying. They had only the evidence of the successes of these men to base their decisions upon. And so there began the process of developing a cult of personality. As time goes by, that ring of wagons gets tighter and tighter in support of their leadership, and they don't want to give up. They want to will the success of their company. So as time went on, the rank and file of SCO did not break away. The rank and file of SCO got more convinced of the sincerity of their leadership. Now you're all sitting out there saying, well, Darryl's a liar. Now why would they believe this kind of stuff? Well, you've got to understand who Darryl McBride is. Darryl McBride is a very convivial man. He is so congenial, so nice, so pleasant. He is a really friendly guy. On more than one occasion, I have sat down at dinner with Darryl McBride to try and have reasonable conversations with him. I find it a lot easier, even with a person you have great difficulty with, to sometimes sit down with them and share a meal. Sometimes a meal, a couple of cocktails, can really break down barriers between two people with conflicting viewpoints. I sat down with Darryl in two such cases and walked away from those dinners wondering what the hell had just happened. This guy was likable. He was a great guy. It was only the next day or the next week that I began to understand that he was telling me exactly what I wanted him to tell me to move me along, to groom me as a potential ally. Didn't work, but that's what he was trying to do. Darryl McBride is very effect at personal manipulation, brainwashing, if you like. This is not necessarily evil. This is just a technique of influencing people to your side of an argument. And that's why Chris Sontag was so important to bring into the organization, because Chris Sontag took the role of Darryl's pit bull. When anything bad had to be done, Chris Sontag did it. Anything that Darryl did, Darryl would be forced into doing. Oh, I don't want to do this, but I have to do this. Those people, that company, are forcing my hand. And when it came time to say really, really bad things about people, it would come out of the mouth of people like Chris Sontag or Blake Stowell. Blake Stowell is the PR guy at SCO. Again, Blake Stowell, great guy, or previously was a great guy during the Ransom Love time frame. So what was it that changed Blake Stowell to believing so much in Darryl McBride? Again, it's the cult of personality. Today's show is brought to you by ISPCon. You can still register for the ultimate ISP event of the year at ispcon.com. We're also sponsored by Fuse, FYUZE.com, the online RSS aggregator. So what has this cult of personality got to do with the Linux leadership? Let's jump back and reprise that article from eWeek of Stephen Vaughn Nichols about, indeed, Linus did want to see the SCO code, but could not do so because of a restrictive NDA. And there was a number of emails and perhaps even telephone calls, if you believe Darryl McBride, that it went on between Darryl and Linus. And in those conversations, the one thing that was impressed upon Linus was that there was this real dichotomy of the guy sounded so sincere and the guy sounded so reasonable, but wrong, just clueless about the code. It's sort of a frightening situation to be in a conversation with a person who seems so sincere. They really appear as if they believe the position that they're telling. And so you begin to wonder. You look over at the table to the left and you see the mountain of evidence that says there is no SCO code in the Linux kernel, period. And you ask yourself, what if I'm wrong? It's that simple. It's a simple question. What if I'm wrong? And so a number of people started asking that question, knowing that we had the evidence in front of us. We began to ask the question, if we were really reasonable people, if we were responsible citizens of the IT community, we have to ask the question, what if we're wrong? What if SCO's complaint really is legitimate? Now, I'm looking at this mountain of evidence that's like 9,000 feet tall, and this evidence is saying there is no code in SCO. At least no Linux code in SCO. Well, there may be no code at all, come to think of it. No code worth anything. But again, if you're going to be intellectually honest with yourself, you have to look at things from the other person's perspective. And so a number of people started to do that and started bantering back and forth various theoretical propositions. Simple things like, if I am the buyer of a product and I neglect to do a clear title search, is it my responsibility as the buyer when a owner comes forward and lays claim to that property? These are simple property ownership laws that have been around the United States for years and years and years. It's the responsibility of the buyer to do a title search. Then there's more humorous perspectives, the if it walks like a duck analogy. But we just couldn't get away from the simple basis of common law, and that is this. A reasonable man has a reasonable expectation that when you have a disagreement with another person, you must presume that person to also be a reasonable man. And so there are a number of statutes, well, I shouldn't say these are statutes, a number of principles within common law that are called the reasonable man standards. And one of the most basic of those reasonable man standards is that in light of overwhelming evidence, you still may be wrong. That is the principle of innocent until proven guilty. And so we all agreed, or we all came to the agreement after much debate, that would it be wrong of us to just point a finger at Darryl McBride and say, you're wrong, you're evil, you're bad, go away. That would be wrong. We needed to be reasonable and still consider the fact that in light of overwhelming evidence, we could be wrong. There could be code that had snuck in by accident. And so being reasonable, we must go to the offended property and offer them the opportunity to prove their case in a reasonable basis and then remediate the situation. Everyone agreed that if indeed it turned out SCO was right, there was code in there, we wanted it removed immediately. So in August of 2003, we began the process of beginning to correspond with Darryl McBride. And when I say we, primarily, it was me on behalf of Eric Raymond and a couple of other people in Linux leadership. And we created a document that was a statement of purpose, statement of principle, that allowed SCO the opportunity for an out, allowed them the opportunity to go to arbitration directly and assemble a team of people like Eric Raymond, take a look at the offending code, and arbitrate the situation as to whether or not SCO had a legitimate claim. The reason for offering this opportunity is really well-founded in basis, and we're still surprised in ways that SCO didn't take us up on the offer. Simply put, if indeed there was code in there, and if indeed that code could be traced to IBM, this would be devastating to IBM. It would support SCO's claim. It would give them the Linux leadership to go up on that stand and testify not against SCO, but on behalf of SCO. This could have been an incredibly potent legal weapon for SCO to take advantage of. So, why didn't they take advantage of it? Thanks for joining us today. This has been the Linux Daily. If you enjoy what we do here, throw a few dollars in the tip jar.